evening we begin tape number 20. One of the very important cornerstones of our philosophy regarding how parents of rebellious teenagers act is that they must learn all about what rebellious teenagers are. Stated that it's important, and this applies to all parents, not only parents of rebellious teenagers. Parents have to learn about the places where their children are going and what they're doing, because what you think is innocuous or what you think is innocent may be anything but. And on the other hand, there may be some things that have a reputation or an illusion of danger for a kid, but it's really not all that bad. And if you make a wrong call on either end, it's confusing for the child, and you're going to lose their trust. Worst case scenario, you're going to lead them into the lion's den. Now, there's another very important reason why parents of rebellious teenagers must get to familiarize themselves with that subculture of the rebellious teenager. You know, you can hear a lot about children. You can read all the books about teenagers that there are. You can go to all the shiurim. But it's not really going to be enough. You can compare it, if you like, to non-Jew reading encyclopedias, going to lectures, magazine articles, sociological reports about Orthodox Jews. We know that no matter how educated they are in terms of what they read or what they hear, how many statistics they know, they really don't get it until they live it. Frum Yiddishkeit is a culture in and of itself, and it really has not been put down on paper as of yet in a way to really give an accurate picture of what it is. Tamu uru'u ki toiv Hashem. You have to taste it in order to understand how good Hashem is. And that means being a Frum Yid. Same thing applies to the world, that strange, bizarre culture, peculiar world of rebellious teenagers. You can hear all the shiurim in the world. You can read all the articles that you can get your hands on. And it will help. But it won't really give you a full, clear picture of what their world is all about. And it is a totally different world until you live it and you experience it. So, I've said, go out and see what it's all about. Now, this evening, we're going to focus on a couple of important points where parents of rebellious teenagers very often miss the boat in terms of assessing where their children are holding. And the reason why they miss the boat is because they are not all that familiar with the other world that the teenagers are in. Now, the tools that I'm going to put forth this evening are going to be useful for assessing progress in your children, for being able to gauge their improvement, or, Rachmana Litzlan, the opposite, in a way that's accurate and in tune with the reality. One of the most difficult things for parents of rebellious teenagers to deal with is how to know when their children are making progress, how to know when they're improving. You know, lots of times they'll see some signs of hope, signs of progress in their children, and then on Motzei Shabbos, the child won't come home. They'll stay out the whole night. And the parent will think, oh my gosh, I thought that progress was being made, and now I see it's not so. steps back, two steps forward, three steps back, things like that. There's no way that you're going to be able to assess where your children are holding unless you understand a few principles. Principle number one is that children are like adults in a very strange way. Now, not every adult is perfect either. Not all of us are perfect here. And as from a Yidden, it's often necessary for us to know how imperfect the people we're dealing with are. For example, you want to go to a restaurant and eat, and you want to be comfortable with the reliability of the kashrus in that establishment. In order to do so, you need to know exactly how imperfect a person and a Talmud Chacham, the Rav HaMachshir, is, how imperfect the Mashgiach is, and the owner of the establishment also. You don't have to know everything about him, but you have to know a certain amount. Now, there's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch that's, in a way, a very big eye-opener, but in a way, it's very poshut. One of those things that we probably all would imagine on our own, but we don't really think about. And it says a lot about how we judge each other and how we should be judged. The halacha is in Yerideya, in Kuf Yud Tes, Hilchos Macholei Akum, Sif Hei. Shulchan Aruch is talking about people who are suspect for doing certain averis. Shulchan Aruch is explaining to us how trustworthy these individuals are. How many averis a person has to do, or what type of averis he has to do, in order to disqualify him as somebody you would rely on, kashrus-wise. Let's say you know somebody is a frum yid, but he doesn't put tefillin on in the morning. You rely on him when he says that the chicken he's selling you comes from Baltimore? Somebody does put on tefillin, but he doesn't really keep Shabbos. You rely on him. And he tells you the ice cream he's giving you will be Yisrael. This is what this chapter in Shulchan Aruch discusses. And I read you Seif Hei. Choshud al Isur Chomor. Choshud al Hakal Mimenu Ba'oinesh. Somebody is suspect, meaning we have reason to believe that he violates a serious sin. And serious is relative. But if somebody is violating a serious sin, he is automatically assumed to be unreliable regarding any sin less strict, any sin more kal. A person violates an avera for which you get misa, as a capital crime, then you have to assume that all other averas that are only a lav, suspect for violating. If somebody doesn't keep Shabbos, somebody doesn't keep Taharas HaMishpacha, you have to assume that that person, wherever it says in the Torah, do not do this, anything less of a punishment than Karas or whatever, this person is suspect for violating. He is unreliable. Worse than Karas, maybe he won't do. Anything less than Karas, he certainly will. Elohim Cain, unless Omer be'enei b'nei odom hanizhorim bo yoyser mi bachomor. Meaning that if this person violates an avera, and this avera is a very serious crime, people don't look at it that way. They look at it like it's not such a serious crime. And that person is not suspect for violating lesser crimes, if those lesser crimes are looked upon by people as worse. I'll give you an example. Let's say a person speaks Lashon Hara. Everybody nowadays knows what a terrible Aveira Lashon Hara is. How many Lavim, and how many Aseis, and how many Klolos. Which is worse? To speak Lashon Hara? Or sell you something that is not 100% kosher. Let's say that not 100% kosher means only midrabbanon. Well, let's say even midairaisa. Only one lav, speaking Lashon Hara, maybe worse. So what are we going to say? That somebody that speaks Lashon Hara, you can't buy in his store? Because if he's guilty of Lashon Hara, certainly he'll do all the lesser crimes? Is that logical to you? If somebody speaks Lashon Hara, he's suspect for any Aveira that's not as great as Lashon Hara. No. As the Shulchan Aruch comes from a Gemara and a Rosh. Choyris taflamid vov amir aleph. People have a perverted version of what Lashon Hara is. They have a twisted value system in which Lashon Hara does not take the place among the serious crimes that it should, then although, yes, that person has a perverted value system, the society he lives in has a perverted value system. The fact of the matter is, if you're judging this person's commitment to kashrus and this person's commitment to Yiddishkeit in general, it cannot be judged by the book severity of Lashon Hara. It has to be judged by the social severity of Lashon Hara. Somebody's guilty of indiscretions in business practices. Let's say he violates Zela. Are you going to say that he's suspect for all the lavim in the Torah? You don't say that. Because unfortunately, indiscretions in business are not considered in the eyes of people as terrible as eating treif. It could be, but it's not. We have a perverted value system. Our value system is not according to the Torah, and it's not only in 20th century America. This is what it says in Shulchan Aruch, and it comes from a Gemara, and it comes with a Rosh. Which means at least it's theoretically possible, and there are examples in the Poskim, hundreds of years already, where there are serious sins that aren't regarded as seriously as they should be. Now, I can't overstate this point, that somebody who looks at Torah with an objective eye is going to look at us as if, and it's not as if, they're going to look at us and they're going to understand that we have a perverted, corrupt, twisted, backwards, topsy-turvy value system to an extent. We don't value the Averis and Mitzvahs, or we don't fear them, we don't give them the seriousness that they deserve according to the Torah. There's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, a Ramah, that not every religious Jew could be relied upon regarding kashrus. In other words, you can't buy food from a Jew just because he's from. You have to know for a fact that he is reliable in his in kashrus, in selling people legitimately kosher items. You have to know for a fact, or you have to have reason to believe. He has to be established as in kashrus in business. Why? Because even though at home he may 100% eat kosher, unfortunately in the eyes of people, even people that eat kosher at home, they'll sell non-kosher to others. But you're allowed to eat in this person's home, but you're not allowed to buy from his store. Well, is he frum or is he not frum? The answer is, nobody's perfect. Many people are imperfect in terms of selling others non-kosher items. That doesn't mean that he would eat treif in his house. It's so important for us to understand this. So important. Now, there's no excuse. There's no reason why we should not look at Lashon Hara according to its real severity. And there's no reason why we shouldn't look at unethical business practices according to its halachic severity. And there's no reason why we should not look at lifnei iver loy sitein michshol, selling other people treif, according to its halachic severity. But we don't. And it's a fact. And when you're judging somebody else's commitment to Yiddishkeit, you can't judge it by the book. You judge it by social styles and the social perceptions of what's considered bad and what's considered not so bad. Again, there's no reason to look at things in a perverted way, but we do. And in all fairness to us, in the interest of honesty and objectivity, if you want to know if somebody's suspect for doing a crime, you can't look in the books and the Shulchan Aruch and the Chumash and say, well, he does a crime where it's Chayiv Karis, so certainly he's going to do a crime that's only Chayiv Malkus. It doesn't work that way. If people don't understand the severity of that Chayiv Krisus, he may do a very more serious crime, but he will not do a lesser crime. That's the halacha. Plus, halacha varies according to time and place. In 20th century America, unethical business practices are considered, unfortunately, acceptable, or not as bad as not putting on tefillin in the morning, or whatever. And we have to judge people accordingly. But if in another country it's not that way, then we judge everybody according to the society that they live in. We judge everybody by the perceptions of their peers according to the time that they live, according to the generation. And without knowing the social attitudes of the particular neighborhood, the particular time and place, the restaurant that you walk into, there's no way that you can pask in the shiloh if you're allowed to eat there or not. I mean, no Rav HaMachshir, you're just relying on the merchant. Now you have the merchant's resume. You know everything about him. You have the data sheet. You have the rap sheet on him. You know everything about the man. You still don't know if he can eat there, because you don't know if his averis are perceived. He is severely, terrible, not so terrible, bad, not so bad. You have to know what's going on socially in order to be able to pask in this shiloh. If you don't know socially, there are things we do in a suffix, but if you want to really know what the halacha is, it's one of the pieces of information you have to have. Now, just like this applies to adults, it applies to our children as well. Our children, particularly rebellious teenagers, have their own perverted value system. We have our perverted value system, and they have their own perverted value system as to what's considered terrible and what's considered not so terrible. And in order to understand where your rebellious teenager is holding, if they are improving, if they are not improving, you must understand this. If you judge them by the book, or if you judge them by your value system, you're going to get a distorted result. Case in point. By many groups of rebellious teenagers, and different groups have different systems, eating treif, if it's not meat, so terrible. Yet it is, but not so terrible. Chil Shabbos, there are levels of Chil Shabbos. Driving in a car, they won't do. Smoking in public, yeah. Why? I don't know. Why do we think Lashon Hara isn't as bad as it is? Why do we treat it like a much lesser crime? That's the way the world works. Our children are the same as us in this. They have different applications. Logically, it makes no sense. Explain to a kid the fact of the matter is if something grows from a tree, it's kosher, period. If you go to a tray for pizza store, and you have tray for oil, a tray for cheese, or whatever it is, the only way that could be treif is if it's related to meat or meat products or animal products, if it's dairy, whatever. And it's the same as meat. Good, one's novella, one's not novella, whatever it is, that's not their cheshbon. It's just a social perversion of the halacha. Similar to our social perversion of unethical business practices. Oh, everybody does it. So, yeah, it's an aveira, but everybody does it. They'll agree it's an aveira, but it's an aveira, everybody does it. Tznius? On the bottom of the list. Issa deraisa, issa derabbanan, chayve krisus sometimes. Everybody does it. Nasus keheter. Our kids that will violate chayve krisus but will put on tefillin every day. Does that make sense? It does. It doesn't make sense logically, but logic does say that these things exist. They've existed for years in many societies, including ours, and this is just a new application of an old rule. For a child, come home past the curfew, or not to come home at all, is nishgefarlich by most of them. It's not a tremendous crime. You can come home at night. Now, a kid does this out. A 15-year-old boy, a 15-year-old girl doesn't come home at night on a Matzah Shabbos. She comes home at 8 in the morning, at 9 in the morning, and the parents are waiting up. And they're Rachmon Litzlan, they're getting heart attacks. They don't know. I called the police already 30 times. What kind of mishugin a kid doesn't come back a whole night? Unfortunately, they don't have to be so mishugah. Because by them, it's not such a terrible crime. Nishkeferlach, I came home late, so I came home 1 hour late, 10 hours late. It's all the same. So many kids that do it. By them, no, nishkeferlach. So I stood out all night. Go to the nightclubs to come back 4 o'clock in the morning is not unusual, it's not late at all. And if you're out until 4 o'clock, 4:30, you go for a Coke to a bagel store afterwards, by the time you get home it's light out. What did I do? They'll say, what did I do so terrible? Ingratitude is just the opposite, by the kids, a terrible crime. They call it using people. Be a user is one of the two greatest criticisms that you can give to a kid nowadays, to a rebellious teenager, a user, somebody that takes and takes and doesn't give back. And that is a terrible crime, much worse than certain things that are chayve krisus. Other is being a hypocrite. Terrible criticism. Kid that'll eat treif will shiver at the thought of being called a hypocrite. Not funny. One day they're going to be speaking about, in a history class, they're going to be speaking about 20th century American Orthodox Jewry. And the teacher's going to say that these people, Lashon Hara, Nasus Keheta, lots of people that spoke, but Lashon Atilas Yadayim, before eating, no frum Jew in his right mind would violate that. And the kid's going to raise him, but I don't understand, Atilas Yadayim is a Drabanan. Lashon Hara is so many Darais, it doesn't make any sense. And the teacher's going to say, yeah, I mean, in the olden days, that's the way it was. It was a weird society. Somebody read a shidduch for your daughter and told you that the boy is a fine boy, but he speaks Lashon Hara. Okay? So he speaks Lashon Hara. You may or may not be bothered by that. But if somebody read a shidduch for your daughter and said the boy doesn't wash before he eats bread, shut the phone on the shadchan. What's so bad about not washing before eating bread? Isn't it a drabanon? So? And if somebody lies, a white lie, chloikis in the rishonim, fiyareim, with others, but somebody lies in a way that it's aser, that's the dairaisim, it vasheka tirchok, which is worse, lying or not washing until it's yadayim. If you heard that a prospective son-in-law once lied, you'd react perhaps with less panic than if you heard that he didn't wash. What terrible avera is it if a boy davens biyachidus by himself on Yom Kippur? He doesn't go to shul on Yom Kippur. What avera did he get? Somebody wants, they could build up a case that there's a mitzvah to go to shul on Yom Kippur, Doshu Hashem, just like there's a mitzvah to do tshuva on Yom Kippur because it's a special time, so part of that is going to shul. Okay, that could be. But otherwise, what is it? You just didn't go to Minyan, same as any other day. Who in his right mind is going to miss Minyan on Yom Kippur? Imagine if somebody tells you a prospective bacha for your daughter-in-law, he overslept this Yom Kippur. He didn't make it to Minyan. What's so terrible about that? I'm not saying it's wrong that we think it's horrendous. It is. But what I'm saying is that what we think is horrendous is inconsistent with other things that are more horrendous, that we are more calm about. The same thing with our kids. In terms of progress, if you want to know if your child is making progress, you have to judge them by their own commitment to Yiddishkeit in their own society. Eventually, we bring them into our perversions, out of their perversions into ours. But at the beginning, you have to judge them based upon their own perversions. And the examples I gave are just Misholem. They're different kids that have different twisted ideas. But the bottom line is that if you want to know if your child made progress, don't judge him by your standards. Judge him by his standards. I'm telling you that probably tznius is the last thing that they're going to do. Hanging around with the wrong friends is the last thing they're going to give up. And if you're talking about something so severe, Shabbos and Kashrus, and they start different levels of Shabbos and Kashrus, this is what it's going to be. Meat is going to come before trefa pizza. Cheeseburgers and pork are going to come before regular novella in McDonald's. I don't know if they make pork cheeseburgers. Alpi halacha, the prohibition of basar b'cholov, of meat and dairy, on a pork cheeseburger is a lot less than that on a regular hamburger cheeseburger. Because if the meat is not from a kosher min, is not from a kosher animal, then leisavashel gedi b'chalev imoy does not apply. How? Even if it wasn't shechted properly, there's still a problem there. So, they don't look in Yeridaya before they decide what's important and what's not important. They look to their peers, like we often do. If you have a kid that's out of school, they want to go back to school. They start certain bizarre practices. You, they're bizarre. Kashrus and Shabbos and whatever. One night Matzah Shabbos, they don't come home. Does not mean two steps forward and three steps back. It means somebody who's becoming a Baal Tshuva and does Kashrus and Shabbos, puts on tefillin, then speaks Lashon Hara, and is still involved in dishonest business practices. You can't judge them by your standards. They have their own standards, their own world. They have no right, this perverted perspective on halacha, but neither do we. It's just a fact. You want to judge your child by the company they keep. I want you to know that the way they judge friends is much different than the way you're going to judge friends. Take a look at the person who your daughter walked out the door with. If you would see this guy walking down the street, you cross over to the other side because you're scared. Maybe he's a big burly guy with this Van Dyke, with his mushroom haircuts and 3 days worth of stubble on his face, dressed in his clothes that looks like he picked it up at the garbage disposal of a flea market in Harlem. What are you, crazy, you tell her? And you figure that this guy is public enemy number one. You expect to see him in the post office. Next time you go to buy stamps, you look at the wanted posters to see your daughter's newfound friend. You expect for sure he's going to be there. A guy that looks like that? Shemu shamayim, tismar sarais enosh v'satzi lenosh tei oznei kol shemeya, rachmano litzlan. To her, he's a nice guy. He's a nice guy. And you know what? Believe it or not, he may be a nice guy. Speak to him, you may find out that he's a well-mannered, when he wants to be, polite, when he wants to be, human being. That doesn't mean he's a tzaddik. He may still be a big Rasha. But judging him by his appearance, you're going to have a radically different perspective than your child will. Because rebellious teenagers have a different perspective on different types of dress than you do. You have to judge them by their standards, not by yours. Even crimes, they have their own itinerary of what's considered an acceptable crime, what's considered unacceptable. Stolen credit cards, checks, these are acceptable, relatively speaking. Hitting somebody over the head with a crowbar is somewhat more severe. Breaking into a house is not acceptable. If you have a friend who's parents have a checkbook and the rips a couple of checks out from the middle and uses them. Unethical business practices, it's considered. Everybody cheats on their taxes. Everybody's doing. There's so many. Everybody's doing it. It's upon what crowd your child's in. These are just mishalim, and they don't apply across the board. Some places they do, some places they don't. The point is that your child may be doing things that are worse and worse. He or she may be making more and more progress because their commitment to Yiddishkeit, according to their perverted scale of what's mitzvahs and averis, they're improving. And what happens is, if a parent looks at a kid like this and says, you're not improving, you're getting worse and worse, it's a terribly discouraging thing for a kid who really, really feels that they are making progress. And there's no rule book that anybody could write or anybody could set forth for you. Because we have no idea which crowds your children are hanging around with. Different crowds have different rules. You have to listen to your child. You have to listen. Go out. You got to see. You got to learn about the culture that your child's in. Only then are you going to be prepared. Only then will you be able to properly assess improvement, backsliding, no progress, whatever. Children use their own standards. Of course, if you can instill within them our standards, it's an accomplishment. Because though we have our perversions and they have our perversions, our society, much better society, much more positively influential society than the society that they're in, that's an accomplishment too. As long as that's not happening, we have to understand that our children have their own ideas. Wrong, perverted, twisted, corrupt, just like us. But they have their own ideas. Once saw a vort from a Rebbe. I saw in two places the name of two different Rebbes. The Rebbe Rabbunim or the Yid HaKadosh. They said that when a kid is little, they want candies. That's their goal in life. Candies, toys, whatever. They get a little older. They want money. Grow up. That's their goal in life. They want money. A little older than that. Maybe they're middle-aged. Maybe older than middle-aged. Next to kuf in a person's life, they want covet. So they're getting older. The money's not helping. They want honor. They want recognition. Eventually they get older and they realize they want Torah. Torah is a level in maturity. A little kid wants candy and toys. It's no different than an older man who wants covet. They're both missing the boat. Both don't understand what they really should be wanting. In some ways, children want the same things as adults. Their ways of obtaining what they want are often more self-destructive than that of adults, often more damaging to their guf and their neshama than adults, but ultimately they may want the same thing. I mean, the truth is that if we'd really be objective about this, we'd have to make a cure of organization for frum adults. Have somebody that spends money, thousands and thousands of dollars, wasting their money on marble floors for their bathrooms. All of the materialism, the hasanas, all the stuff that we talk about. We should really make a cure of organization. We have social workers explaining to them that this is a self-destructive, it's not good, it's a distraction from life, it's a waste of money, you could be doing good things. We should have Balei Hashkofa explaining to the people that we're in this world for other things and this is only a distraction from your ultimate goal and it's only a twisted application and a twisted expression of your neshama's yearning for Torah that you're trying to accomplish by this bizarre behavior, this acting out. Make an organization. for materialistic adults, a cure of organization to straighten out the heads. We don't do that because we're the ones making the organizations and we're the adults. Our kids want the same recognition. Instead of the marble garbage cans, they put on a leather jacket. The person with the marble garbage can, they're hanging around with the wrong crowd. Really are. Because people whose heads are on straight are not going to give them respect or honor for their marble garbage cans. Whoever they are going to get their respect and honor from, that's the wrong crowd. Really hanging out with the wrong people. It's like the kid who gets his covet from his leather jacket. Only a question of degrees of how bad the crowd is. They are both a misexpression of something deeper. That's all it is. And in this way, kids are definitely like adults. They have their own ideas of what progress is, their own ideas of right and wrong, their own things that they accept, and we have to understand that. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to assess them properly. The second thing that we need to know that we're often fooled by is the relationship between actions and thoughts. There are two dimensions to a teenager that you can focus on and try to enhance, try to change. One is the activities, behaviors, actions, environment, those things that are measurable, those things that they do. Somebody who's out of school, you get them into school. Somebody who doesn't keep Shabbos, you get them to keep Shabbos. Somebody who doesn't eat kosher, you get them to eat kosher. Somebody who's stealing, you get them to stop stealing. This is progress. Then there's another type of progress. That's out of school, you get them to want to be in school. Somebody who's not from, you get them to want to be from. You set goals for them. Now, you would think that the wanting to be from and the wanting to be in school is a relatively small accomplishment compared to being in school. Not always so. You have a kid who's in school and wants to be out of school. Very often that's worse than a kid who's out of school and wants to be in school. Three mishalim for this. One, I remember when I was in yeshiva in Chaim Berlin, there was an applicant to the yeshiva who came from another institution. My yeshiva, we'll call it, a pseudo yeshiva. Wanted to come to Chaim Berlin, and he was a good boy. But Rav Huttner, after speaking to him, would not allow him to enter Chaim Berlin. And he explained why. He said, better he should be there and want to be here than to be here and want to be there. Very, very astute assessment. Very wise decision. Where does this person want to be? That says a lot about a person, even if they're not there. What are their goals? What are their aspirations? There's a certain Rebbe Azar who once said the same idea, and the mushal he used was a tightrope walker. Now this tightrope walker is up there, 100 feet off the ground, walking maybe in the Grand Canyon, a tightrope. One wrong move and he's dead. What's the trick? Oh, keep your eyes focused. The trick more than anything else to keep your balance and not fall off is to keep your eyes focused on where you want to go. If you're tottering a little this way and teetering a little that way, the main thing is to keep your focus on the other end of the tightrope. And that's the best way for the rest of your body to follow. Once your focus gets off that point, you're in big trouble. Like I said, I don't know much about tightrope walking, but when I was a kid, I heard the same thing from a skiing instructor in Hunter Mountain. He said that when you're careening down side of a mountain at breakneck speed, the way to stay on track is not so much to try to aim your body, your legs, your arms, your shoulders in the right direction, but rather your eyes. Keep your head pointed, your eyes focused in the right direction. That's the best way the rest of your body will follow. So simple. I don't recommend anybody taking a vacation and start careening down mountains based on this. That's the rule. Where your eyes are focused is very important in terms of knowing where you will end up. Will you end up in the woods, tattered on the side of a tree, or will you end up where you're supposed to be? More than anything else, it depends where you were looking, where you were focused. The same thing applies to children. It's a tremendous accomplishment when a child changes their attitude, their focus, where they have their eyes locked on. Do they have their eyes locked on school now? Do they have their eyes locked on Torah and mitzvahs now? It's a tremendous accomplishment. It should not be minimized. It's sometimes a greater accomplishment than a kid getting into school through coercion. Because now they're here, but they want to be there. As opposed to being there and wanting to be here. In terms of what's going to last, what's going to have an effect, what in the long run is going to produce results, focus is invaluable. Now, lots of times parents will live with a child for a year or two, and the kid's still out of school, and the kid's still not wearing long skirts, and the kid's still not coming home on time. If that's the entire basis that you judge progress by, guilty of two indiscretions. Number one, you're going to be discouraging the kid to no end. Because if this kid has set more wholesome goals, or wholesome objectives, focused their eyes on a target that's in the right place, and through nurturing, growth, children do grow. While teenager starts at 13, by the time they're 17, 18, they are a different person. Better or worse, but they are a different person. There are many natural crossroads in a child's life. Many natural times where change is just waiting for them. Let's say a child is out of school, but they're 17 years old, and all the friends of theirs who were in school are now going to college or going off to Eretz Yisrael. That's a natural nexus for a kid. It gets him thinking. That's a weak point. The Yetzirah's weak point. There are many such natural crossroads. And if a child's mind is focused on the right place, even if they don't have the willpower or the capability or whatever it is to actually bring their goals to fruition, if we can maintain and nurture that those goals and objectives and wait until the kid gets a hear her tshuva, and very often it happens sooner or later, and it could be used to turn the kid around. The first indiscretion is the disappointment. The second indiscretion is that you are losing such a tremendous advantage. Such a tremendous advantage if you have a kid with the goals focused in the right place. It's much different than a kid who doesn't have those goals. They could be doing the same things, they could be acting the same ways, the same behaviors, the same crowd, but they are two different kids. Our approach to the rebellious teenagers should be on two levels. Level one, behavioral accomplishments. He goes to school, kid stops crime, kid does keep Shabbos. And two, this is the thing that's most often neglected, accomplishments in terms of setting goals and objectives, what they want to do, where they want to be. Now, the reason why this is so often neglected is because parents of rebellious teenagers, from parents of rebellious teenagers, often get very impatient. I want to see progress. All this esoteric, philosophical stuff, goals, objectives, schmoles, schmectives, don't mean nothing if the kid is sitting on the street to these parents. Don't mean nothing if the girl comes back 5 o'clock in the morning with some guy in the Firebird. It doesn't mean anything to parents very often if the kid is still eating in Domino's pizza. It's an error. It's a big error. Because there is no magic wand and there is no overnight cure-all for teenage rebelliousness. Very often, it's a long haul. And if the child's insides, if that esoteric, philosophical, yes, part of a child is straight, and one day, sooner or later, the chances are you're going to be able to use that, then they're going to change. Another reason why parents neglect this part of children's progress is because parents don't have a relationship with the child anyway. The parents can't talk to the child. Then these goals or objectives are of little use to the parents. Parents have a relationship with the child. If they have open communications, then when that nexus comes in his life, when that hirhur tshuva, when that jukin cup is there, because of everything you've been pumping them and everything that you've been working on all of these years, all these months, has a delayed effect. It's all there. It all has an effect. If the time comes to pounce and to say, okay, you want help? Grab my hands. We'll get you out of here. It'll only work if throughout these months or throughout these years you've had open communications with the kid. If you anyway don't have any communications with the kid and you're watching from the bleachers as the child runs around in circles, then you're right. These goals and objectives are of little use to you because you'll never be able to take advantage of them anyway. You'll never be able to use them the way they could be used. It's such a valuable tool, but you're incapable of taking advantage of it. So important for parents to open communications with the child. Why? And a parent comes back and after a month or 2 months, I have open communication, so what did it accomplish me? He's still doing this and she's still doing that. What it accomplished is that one day, Be'ezras Hashem, when the child is ready to return to Yiddishkeit, you're going to be there to help them do it. If one day the child gets thought that they want help, it happens. These children are confused, and if one day a dread of sanity surfaces amidst all that confusion, and the child, the drowning child, sticks out his hand, who's going to be there to take it? You're there for months and feasts just in order to be able to make that closing. You know, if you're a businessman, you want a contract, you cultivate your prospective client for a long time. You take him out to lunch, you do all sorts of things with him. What did you accomplish? Accomplish that when the time is ripe and is looking to buy whatever it is that you sell, spoons, for instance, you're going to be there. You're going to be there. All of it, all of the background, all the months and months of effort are all there. When he's ready, you're going to make the closing. Same thing with a kid, but much more intensely. You've got to be there. Cultivate the relationship so that when one day this kid wants to buy what you have to sell, even if they're not 100% sure, boom, you're there. Somebody else. Call this the principle of lock and load. Lock and load. You gotta keep your ammunition ready all the time so that when the target pops up, bang, you got it. You gotta keep the gun loaded and pointed. That's the relationship. So that when the time comes, all you have to do is pull the trigger. Otherwise, you know what happens. A kid 16 years old, all of a sudden, like they're ready to come back. All the work that's been put into them is finally bearing fruits. But now, the parents aren't there to help because the parents haven't spoken a word to the child in 8 months. Friends are all undesirable characters. So, it's much harder for the child. And these Hirhurei Tshuva don't last long. They don't last long. When the opportunity comes, you got to be available. If you're not available, no, it's like a guy comes and he wants to buy your spoons and you don't even know him. You heard a rumor in the street that this and this company wants to buy 10 million spoons and you sell spoons. You don't know them, you have nothing to do with them. What are you going to do? Are you going to start cultivating the relationship? If you're familiar with the person and you're friendly, you've been friendly for a long time, you got a shot at the contract. Why is it worthwhile? Just do nothing with the kid. Just open up communications about Dvarim B'Teilim, about Dvarim Shel Mabekach, about unimportant matters. You know why? Because when the kid wants to come back, when the kid is thinking about coming back, that may cross his mind as an unimportant matter. He may nonchalantly mention it to a friend of his while eating pizza. It goes in one ear and out the other. If all your child has to do with you is to ask you for money or to call you when they get hurt or whatever, they're not going to call to you for help. Because the cry for help usually doesn't come in a panic. It comes at a fleeting, casual thought. Have a relationship with the kid where fleeting, casual thoughts are communicated and exchanged, and you may get wind of that opportunity. And boom, you've got him. And you pull the trigger. It's like making a sale. Collecting money for a yeshiva. It's like any business deal, any time you deal with people. It's the same thing. You cultivate a relationship, you're there, your ears are open, your eyes are open, and you're always ready for the right moment. Lock and load. That moment comes, boom, you're there. In short, this evening we learned two things. One, that children are very much like their parents, and two, children are nothing like their parents. Children have their own value system. If you want to understand where your child's holding, you have to learn their value system, because they're going to use it the same way we use it. Two, setting goals and objectives is a very, very important and necessary part of progress. Although it does not give visible results, what it does is sets them up that the visible results come quickly and effectively in that time of Siyata Dishmaya arrives. And now we're going to take questions. Question. A prominent Rav in the neighborhood had recently said that if you have problems with your children, you should examine your own value system. The example given was, if you make your money through some questionable business dealings and that money goes to pay the tuition of your children, then that may affect the quality of the education. This being the case, is it not very important for parents to clean up their own act before they expect to clean up their children's? The answer is yes. And by the way, this Rav said, principle is true. It's all founded in many places, first and foremost in the Zohar, and it works both on esoteric levels and simple gashmius levels. This is surprising that it was a Chassidish Rav that said this, but it works, and it's true, it's 100% true. It works also on more natural, Derech HaTeva channels as well. If a child sees his parents having questionable business practices, so then the parent immediately is one of the two cardinal sins, one of two top apikorsim in the eyes of a child, namely a hypocrite. And this being the case, of course parents have to clean up their act before they the children too. However, even if a child doesn't see or know what the parents do, the attitude is going to come out and it's going to filter down through to the kid. And yeah, there are many, many, many things that we can do that are segulois, that help us help our children. And yes, it's true. One of them is that the money that we give to our children for tuition should be kosher amani. There's a story in the Gemara with Rav Chisda. When he made a yeshiva, he did everything by himself. He did everything by hand. Planted the seeds, chopped the wood, everything, all by himself. Because he wanted to make sure the education that those children get are unpolluted. Hard thing nowadays, but yes, 100%. That's what it says in the Svarim, that does happen. Well, good night, everybody. You've been a wonderful audience. See you next week. Im Yirtzeh Hashem.